In the summer of 1997, 23-year-old Tabitha Buck was sitting in her jail cell in Lancaster County when a guard told her that she had a visitor. She had been in this county prison for 5 years, convicted of second-degree murder in the case of Laurie Sho. When she was 17 years old, she and a fellow teenager named Michelle Lambert forced their way into 16-year-old Laurie Sho's apartment and brutally murdered her. Today, she did not feel like having a visitor. But oddly, the guard insisted she talk to this person. Tabitha was escorted to the visitor's area and sat down across from a former inmate and friend she had made during her time in prison. According to Lynn Riddle's book, Overkill, this friend took Tabitha's hand and told her some disturbing news. Michelle Lambert was out of prison and declared innocent. Tabitha was in shock. According to Overkill, after she heard the news, she ran back to her cell and sobbed. As a prison guard comforted her, she just kept saying, "This can't be true. This can't be true. I saw what she did." Hi, strangers. This is your host, Alexa Morrissey, and this is part 3 of The Murder of Laurie Sho. So if you haven't listened to parts 1 through 2 yet, please do so now. In part 2, we ended with Michelle's appeal being taken on by a federal court judge. Michelle's new defense team had brought forward instances of prosecutorial and police misconduct in the first trial and suggested that Michelle had been framed for the murder of Laurie Sho. On April 15, 1997, Michelle Lambert was released and declared innocent. New evidence from the trial exposed that Lawrence Yunkin was seen near the scene of the crime the morning of Laurie's murder, and some of the clothes discarded after the murder did belong to him. So it begs the question, who is Lawrence Yunkin? And was he Laurie Sho's real murderer? This is the final part of The Murder of Laurie Sho. Lock your doors and listen closely. This is Stranger in the House. Lawrence Yunkin was born March 12, 1971, in Coatesville, Pennsylvania. His mother, Jackie, married his biological father when she was 18, but according to Overkill, he wasn't ready for a family. They married, but their relationship was short-lived, and they divorced in 1973. Lawrence's father only saw him a few times after the divorce, and then disappeared from their lives. The only connection that Lawrence had to his father was his nickname, Butch, which was something that his father was also referred to as. Jackie raised Lawrence on her own for a long time. She was on welfare and worked at a restaurant to support her and her son. Not too long after the split with Lawrence's biological father, Jackie met a man named Barry Yunkin. According to Overkill, right after they started dating, Barry immediately took to Lawrence and became a father figure to him. In June of 1974, Barry and Jackie married, and Lawrence took Barry's last name. According to Overkill, Lawrence grew up in Paradise, Pennsylvania, 7 miles from Lancaster. People knew young Lawrence as a sweet but shy kid. He struggled in school, but excelled in athletics. He played basketball, football, soccer, hockey, and even threw javelin. He was tall, tan, blonde, and looked like a California surfer by the time he was 19 years old. And as he worked as a lifeguard at his apartment complex's pool, he started to notice that he was getting a lot of attention from girls. One girl in particular caught his interest while he was lifeguarding. When he asked a friend who the girl with the big brown eyes was, his friend said, "That's Lisa Michelle Lambert." There are some aspects to Michelle Lambert and Lawrence Yunkin's relationship that are up for debate, but there is no denying that it was extremely toxic and abusive. In part 2, we heard Michelle's side of the story, a disturbing tale of a young man who endlessly beat and sexually assaulted her. Even Lawrence and his mother admitted that he got violent with Michelle on at least one occasion. But like everything in this story, there's more than meets the eye. According to Overkill, in the summer of 1991, Jackie Yunkin was excited to hear that her 20-year-old son, Lawrence, was dating a new girl named Laurie Sho. According to Overkill by Lynn Riddle, Jackie wasn't a huge fan of Lawrence's previous girlfriend, Michelle Lambert. Soon after Lawrence and Michelle had started dating, Jackie let Michelle move in with her family. And she found Michelle to be disturbingly jealous and controlling of her son. She found that Michelle would get upset whenever Lawrence did anything without her, and would even get jealous when Jackie showed affection to her son. Jackie overheard her yell at Lawrence one night for kissing his mother on the cheek. According to Overkill, Jackie overheard Michelle say, "That's your mother. You're not supposed to kiss your mother." Michelle even asked Jackie why she hugged her son so much. Jackie was becoming annoyed with Michelle, and soon her son and his girlfriend's fights were getting out of hand. They would have screaming matches over their mutual jealousy, and she even saw her son hit Michelle. The Yunkins were asked to leave their apartment complex soon after Michelle moved in, which Jackie believed was because of the intensity of their fights. Lawrence and Michelle ended up moving into a trailer together while Jackie and her husband moved into a new apartment. Jackie wasn't thrilled about Michelle and Lawrence living together on their own. Their relationship was toxic and violent. So when Jackie heard that he had broken up with her and that her son was dating a new girl, she hoped this would be a fresh start for Lawrence. What she didn't know was that Lawrence dating 16-year-old Laurie Sho would not finally bring peace to her son. In fact, it would be the catalyst for Lawrence's downfall and a murder that would shock Lancaster to its core. In 1997, Michelle Lambert filed a habeas corpus petition and had her case heard by a federal judge. With new lawyers willing to stop at nothing in order to get Michelle out of prison, Michelle Lambert was presented as a battered woman who had been framed for the murder of 16-year-old Laurie Sho by the East Lampeter Police of Lancaster. In Judge Dalzell's 1997 opinion, he wrote that Michelle was innocent of first-degree murder and that she was the victim of prosecutorial misconduct. He said that police had tampered with evidence, editing a videotape to hide evidence implicating Lawrence, and moved and restaged Laurie's body for crime scene photos. There was also the fact that a blatant lie about a teenage girl hearing Michelle wanting to slit Laurie's throat was used as evidence. The police had allegedly lost the original pair of pants that Michelle allegedly wore the morning of the murder and replaced them with a smaller pair as to undermine Michelle's claim that the pants were too big for her to wear that morning. There was no physical evidence that linked Michelle to the murder, and unlike Tabitha, she had no scratches or injuries after the attack. Dalzell believed that after hearing expert testimony, Laurie Sho was not able to speak that morning, and therefore did not make the dying declaration that Michelle was her murderer. He then reiterated that Lawrence Yunkin had lied on the stand in the first trial. If you remember, Lawrence had said that he had no idea what the girls were planning to do to Laurie that morning, and then he perjured himself by admitting that he did in fact know that they were going to attack her. That perjured testimony was used to convict Michelle. Dalzell also referenced the letter written between Michelle and Lawrence that, in his opinion, contained enough of a confession for Lawrence to be seen as the real murderer of Laurie Sho. Dalzell stated that Lawrence had raped Laurie Sho on one of their dates, just as he had done to Michelle Lambert. But unlike Michelle, Laurie had told her mother about the event, and they were threatening to press charges. Because of this, Lawrence created a plan to intimidate Laurie, which ended in her murder. Michelle was released, while Lawrence Yunkin and Tabitha Buck remained in jail. According to Lynn Riddle's book, Overkill, the day Michelle Lambert was released from prison, she went home with her lawyers, married couple, Christina Rainville, and her husband, Peter Greenberg. Rainville took Michelle to restaurants, taught her how to dress, and helped her get a job as a secretary. She lived with her lawyers for 3 months and then moved in with a friend in Williamton, Pennsylvania in July of 1997. And then she eventually got her own place. One might wonder why Michelle hadn't gone home to her parents in Lancaster after all this time away. they were the same parents that were raising her young daughter that she had had while she was in prison. Well, right before Michelle was arrested for Lori's murder, Michelle and her parents had a sort of falling out. Michelle's parents had discovered that Michelle had been stealing from them. Her mother's coin collection and $150 in cash were missing from the house, and her parents knew Michelle took it. They actually called the police and forbade her from ever coming back home again. Despite this, Michelle was seemingly getting a fresh start. But her release had shocked not only Lancaster, Pennsylvania, but the entire nation. And Dalzell's decision would eventually be called into question. Michelle Lambert's 1997 appeal brought forward serious accusations of police and prosecutorial misconduct. And while Michelle was released and the case seemingly closed, it was now up to the FBI to investigate what happened in Lancaster in 1992 that led to Michelle's alleged false imprisonment. If you remember from part two, Michelle claimed that Officer Robin Weaver and two other policemen broke into Michelle's apartment and gang-raped her 6 months before Lori Shaw's murder. Michelle's lawyer, Christina Rainville, alleged that the police department framed Michelle for the murder to cover for their co-workers and friends. While the claim seemed outrageous to the town of Lancaster, there was some suspicious activity that happened during the initial investigation and the trial, specifically involving Officer Weaver. According to Rainville, there was a police report by Weaver that stated that Hazel Shaw, Lori's mother, had called Lori from the school counselor's office the morning of her murder to tell her daughter that she was on her way home. According to this report, Lori told her mother that Michelle was either in or on her way to the apartment. This phone call was never brought up in any other testimony by Hazel Shaw. And phone records show that the call never happened. So someone was lying. And while on the surface it would seem that it was Hazel, one had to wonder if it was Weaver falsifying the report to make Michelle look more guilty. There was also the fact that Robin Weaver had mentioned Michelle's allegations of rape in his 1992 deposition. The issue with this was that Michelle had not officially accused him of rape until 1997. But the biggest allegation of misconduct made by Rainville was that the police had removed Lori Shaw's body and staged it to make Michelle's story less credible. Following these accusations in 1997, the FBI began their investigation into the East Lampeter Police Department of Lancaster. While the investigation was underway, the Supreme Court took notice of Dalzell's decision to release Michelle and bar the state from ever retrying her again. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court found that Dalzell did not have the power to ban the state from ever retrying Michelle. And they said that Dalzell should have never been able to take her case on in the first place. If you remember from part two, Michelle had her first two appeals denied and was supposed to have filed a PCRA petition to have those appeal denials reviewed before she filed a habeas corpus petition. Michelle did not file a PCRA and went straight to the federal courts instead, which is how Dalzell got a hold of her case. Just as a reminder, a PCRA petition is the next step if all your appeals have been denied. A PCRA is an indirect appeal, essentially asking the court to reconsider the accused's conviction after a direct appeal to the Superior Court was unsuccessful. Once the PCRA fails and the state court remedies have been exhausted, that's when you file for a habeas petition in federal court. While not filing a PCRA doesn't seem like a huge misstep on Michelle's part, according to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, it was. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals found that Michelle had brought her case to the federal courts prematurely, without exhausting her opportunities for appeal in Pennsylvania. So, on a technicality, Dalzell's ruling was overturned, and the state of Pennsylvania was going to retry Michelle Lambert for the murder of Lori Shaw once again. After 10 months of freedom, Michelle got the news. She would have to return to prison while she awaited a third trial. This trial was going to be different, however, because for the first time, Tabitha Buck, the girl who allegedly murdered Lori Shaw despite having no personal connection to her whatsoever, was finally ready to tell her side of the story. Tabitha Faith Buck was born in Anchorage, Alaska, on May 26, 1974. Both her parents had children from other relationships, but Tabitha was the second daughter they had had together. Tabitha had an older sister named Kitty and seven half-brothers and sisters. The nine children and two parents all lived in the same house. Tabitha's mother raised the children, and her father worked on commercial fishing boats and as a part-time preacher. When Tabitha was around 4 years old, her family moved to Oregon and then Wyoming a year later. By the time she was 17, Tabitha had moved 18 times in five different states, spanning from Alaska to Florida. According to Overkill, Tabitha says her family was very poor and struggled to make ends meet. At one point, the family lived in tents in the mountains of Oregon, with their only luxury being an outhouse their father built for them. When Tabitha was 12, her parents separated. After the divorce, her mother and the two younger siblings, Tabitha and Kitty, moved to a town in Oregon to be closer to family and start a new life. According to Overkill, Tabitha's cousins described her as fun-loving and sensitive. Around this time, Tabitha was an honor roll student, in the school band, and played volleyball and softball. A couple years later, when Tabitha's oldest half-sister got married, her mother went to the wedding and reconnected with her first husband. The issue was that he lived far away from her mother, and after months of long distance, Tabitha's mother decided to move her kids and her life to be with her first husband. That's when they moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Tabitha was 14 when she moved to Lancaster, and she wasn't a fan of her new stepfather. Before the move, she and her siblings lived a very wild and spontaneous life. With a new parental figure in a new town, Tabitha found that she had to abide by many more rules than she had ever had before. She was used to wide open spaces, and now felt smothered by the row house that she moved into. They lived in a rough part of town, and Tabitha begged her mother to let her go live with her father, who had moved back to Alaska. Her mother said no, but when she was in 10th grade, she was able to go live with her older brother, who lived in Oregon. According to Overkill, she loved living with her brother. But eventually he got married and was ready to start a family of his own. Tabitha moved back to Lancaster with her mother, who was taking care of her now terminally ill stepfather, in 1990. She enrolled at Conestoga Valley High School, the same school that Michelle Lambert had dropped out of a year earlier, and where Lori Shaw would eventually attend. Around this time, Tabitha started to date a boy named Keith Palmer, and on one of their dates, he introduced her to two of his friends, Michelle Lambert and Lawrence Youngkin. According to Overkill, Tabitha was struck by how attractive Lawrence and Michelle were, and how devoted they seemed to each other. She described them as seeming obsessed with each other. According to Tabitha, they would either be grossly affectionate or Michelle would get aggressively mean with Lawrence, who just seemed to let it go. While she was dating Keith, Lawrence and Michelle would drive them places. And when Tabitha and Keith broke up, she still relied on Lawrence and Michelle for rides around town. Tabitha knew Michelle as a nice girl, but they weren't close friends. According to Tabitha, the fact that Michelle was a pregnant high school dropout didn't matter to her, as some of her siblings had done the same thing. Tabitha grew up in a free-spirited home for most of her life and didn't think anything of Michelle's choices or the excessive makeup and blue contacts she wore. Michelle told Tabitha that she didn't look this way for Lawrence. In fact, she told Tabitha that she changed her own appearance to look as white as possible, which Tabitha distinctly remembers being annoyed at because at the time she was dating a biracial boy. Tabitha's mother didn't like Michelle. Michelle often lied to Tabitha and her mother to make them feel sorry for her. She told them that she didn't really have a mother because her mother was a prostitute and was never around. Years later, Tabitha's mother would be shocked to learn that Michelle actually came from a deeply religious and respected family. In 1991, Tabitha knew that Michelle was having a problem with a girl named Lori Sho. Tabitha didn't know Lori well, but she did ride the school bus with her. She says that she didn't know the extent of Michelle's hatred of Lori until she entered the Sho's apartment that morning with her. According to Overkill, right before Michelle's 97 federal appeal, Tabitha received a letter from Michelle's lawyer, Christina Rainville. Rainville told Tabitha that she had new information that linked Lawrence as the true murderer of Lori Sho, and that with this new evidence, Tabitha may even get a new trial. Tabitha's own lawyers encouraged her to tell Rainville anything she knew about Lawrence's involvement, but she said that any new evidence Rainville had discovered was simply not true. She said that Lawrence was never in the apartment that morning and didn't participate in the murder. Less than a year after Michelle Lambert was released from prison, she was sent back to await her retrial for the first-degree murder of Lori Sho. Initially, the case was supposed to be presided over by Judge Dalzell again, the same judge that had freed Michelle. But the Pennsylvania Attorney General, Michael Fisher, did not want Dalzell to be the judge on this retrial. In a written statement from Fisher, he says, "We have argued that a reasonable person would not believe that Judge Dalzell would render an unbiased opinion in this case, based on his 1997 decision and the actions he has taken since then. We will continue to argue for justice in this case." With this, Fisher called for Dalzell to recuse himself from the case. This means that Dalzell would have to declare himself unqualified to perform legal duties because of a potential conflict of interest or lack of impartiality. And Dalzell refused to do so. Many people, including Lori Sho's parents, believed that Dalzell was against the Lancaster Police Department from the beginning of the trial, and they were deeply offended that he believed that Hazel Sho was lying about her daughter's final words. In a quote from the New York Times, Hazel said, "Lori could have been mouthing something to me across the street, and I'd know what she was saying. And you have the audacity to tell me that I don't know the last words that came out of my daughter's mouth." In February of 1998, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court gave Michelle's case back to the Lancaster County Court, as that's where she was supposed to have her PCRA appeal first heard before she ever went to the federal court. And Judge Lawrence Stengel, the judge from the original 1992 trial, was assigned to the case. In May of 1998, Michelle Lambert was back in court with the lawyers that had gotten her out of jail before, hoping that they could do it again. Christina Rainville was once again ready to fight tooth and nail for Michelle's innocence. But this time, Rainville had a worthy opponent, prosecutor Chrissy Fawcett. Fawcett was ready to prove that the allegations against the Lancaster police and the prosecution were completely false, and that Michelle was the true murderer of Lori Sho. If you remember from part two, the defense's argument was that the police were eager to pin the murder on Michelle because they were covering for three officers who had attacked and raped Michelle earlier that year. Rainville said that the crime scene photos were staged by the police to make it look like Michelle was lying in her initial statement. Michelle had said that during the fight with Tabitha, Lori threw the phone across the room. In the crime scene photos, Lori has a phone cord wrapped around her leg, suggesting that Michelle's version didn't happen. No initial reports by the police had mentioned the phone cord wrapped around her leg, suggesting that it wasn't there when the police took their initial reports. Rainville said that it was human nature to make mistakes, but the amount of mistakes in this first trial all led to Michelle's conviction. There were too many for just to be incompetence by the police and prosecutors. Now, what Rainville called a cover-up, Fawcett called inconsequential to Michelle's guilt. Since the 97 trial, probes into the Lancaster District Attorney's Office and the East Lampeter Township Police Department by the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the State Judicial Conduct Board, and the Pennsylvania Attorney General's Office all cleared the authorities that put Michelle Lambert away. According to these investigations, there was no misconduct on the part of the police department or the district attorney's office during the initial investigation into Lori's murder. Much of this investigation isn't available to the public, but what we do know is that everyone Rainville had accused of misconduct, including Officer Robin Weaver, was cleared by the FBI. In the 1997 trial, Judge Dalzell found it extremely suspicious that Weaver had mentioned the rape allegations in his first deposition, before Michelle had ever officially accused him. But it would have been normal practice for the district attorney to preemptively coach him about the allegations before she officially accused him, because according to Weaver, she had been talking about those allegations to others, even though she had not officially reported the crime to the police. The elaborate story of the police moving Lori's body from the morgue to retake crime scene photos was also determined extremely improbable, as over 100 different individuals would have had to be in on the scheme and work together for it all to go off the way Christina Rainville explained. Rainville's story of the photo restaging suggested that the police, the prosecutors, and the coroner conspired together to take a teenage girl's dead body from the morgue, which was located under a nursing home on a busy street, transported it back to the second floor apartment where the Shows lived, and no witnesses saw this happen. There was no physical evidence that suggested that the photos had been staged, not to mention that all of this would have had to happen between Michelle giving her statement to the police around 6 a.m. that morning and the autopsy that happened at 8:30 a.m. that morning. This would have also had to have happened during rush hour, when many people in the area would be leaving their houses for work. But again, there were no witnesses to this. On the stand, the original coroner refuted the statements that Lori's Show had ever been taken from the morgue. The body had been brought to the morgue the afternoon of December 20th, the day of the murder. The family viewed the body at the morgue that night, and the autopsy began promptly at 8:30 that morning. A policewoman who lived across the street, Renee Schuler, also confirmed this story in her testimony by saying that she saw the body leave and never be brought back that day. Another big accusation from the 97 trial was that the police had edited a video of their initial search for the pink plastic bag with the clothes that Tabitha and Michelle had worn that morning and discarded. There was no denying that the officer who took the stand in the 97 trial and said that they had never found a pink bag had perjured himself. And the main issue with the unedited video was that this detective was seen suspiciously motioning to cut the cameras. Regardless of this, Fawcett said that before and after this motion, the bag was cut open and emptied. So it didn't matter. An empty bag is still just an empty bag. And showing the unedited version of the tape would not have affected the outcome of the first trial. Aside from this, it turned out that the police nor the prosecution had edited the tape. William Roberts, a professional scuba diver and videographer, was brought in by the police to film the search. He reviewed, edited, and copied it for the police and the DA's office. According to Roberts, the editing he did was for the pure purpose to cut out walking, cut down spam time, and to, quote, eliminate background noise. This negated the accusation that the police had purposefully edited the footage to hide evidence. There was also the issue of the statements that Michelle claimed she signed without knowing what they were. If you remember from part two, in the 97 trial, Michelle claimed that during her initial questioning by the police, she signed two blank pieces of paper given to her by Detective Raymond Salt, and then he allegedly filled those two papers with a false statement. Rainville cited that the fact that the last two pages of the statement were handwritten while the rest were typed was evidence that Michelle could have signed the blank paper and it was filled in later. Now, the first part of Michelle's accusation in the 97 trial was that before she signed these blank papers, she was given a polygraph test and was administered, quote, truth serum. This accusation was immediately dismissed by the judge, as there was literally no such thing as truth serum. And even if there was, the small East Lampeter police that had not had a murder case in a decade certainly did not have it handy. Right away, the credibility of the story was tarnished. According to Detective Salt, the type papers contained statements from Michelle that said she was wearing her own clothes the morning of the murder. But after she gave these statements, Salt told Michelle that he believed she was being dishonest. And that's when she changed her story. According to Salt, she then admitted to wearing Lawrence's sweatpants the morning of the murder. This new statement about her wearing Lawrence's pants was then handwritten by Salt. Each page of the 7-page document was signed by Michelle. But the biggest accusation that Rainville had presented in the 97 trial was that Hazel Show was lying about her daughter's dying declaration. In 1997, Rainville had brought forth a professor of speech to testify that it was impossible for Lori to have spoken that morning with her injury. Now, the issue with this expert was that he was not a medical professional, but a professor of speech. This time, the prosecution brought forward 6 different medical experts. They were all given the same facts that were presented in the first trial, and not a single expert ruled the dying declaration impossible. They said it was unlikely, and it would have been extremely difficult for Lori to talk, but they could not rule it impossible. The only individual who ruled it impossible was the speech professor brought in by Rainville. Rainville had also brought forward a police report that stated that Hazel Show said she had called Lori that morning from the counselor's office, which was irrefutably false. While this suggested that either Hazel or the officer who took the report, Robin Weaver, who Michelle was accusing of rape, had lied, the report of this call was not used in the first trial and was never mentioned again in anyone else's testimony, meaning that regardless of the report's existence, it did not affect Michelle's first conviction, which Rainville had argued was unlawful in 1997. In part 2, we were also presented with a letter that was exchanged between Lawrence and Michelle that Rainville argued proved that Lawrence was the actual killer of Lori. The letter contained several questions from Michelle regarding the day of the murder and the crime itself, and answers were then written in by Lawrence. One of the questions Michelle asked was, "Should I still cover up that you helped Tabby kill Lori? Are you absolutely sure?" To which Lawrence responded, "Yes, I'm positive." In the 97 trial, a handwriting expert confirmed that Lawrence's answers to Michelle's questions were in fact written by Lawrence and had not been altered. But he also said that there was a possibility that Michelle's questions had been altered. Lawrence Youngkin testified that while the answers in the letter were correct, the questions had been changed since he first read it. According to him, the letter, which was written in pencil, had contained several different questions and had been altered to make it look like he confessed to the crime. Lawrence Youngkin admitted that his relationship with Michelle was toxic and abusive at times, but he stuck to his initial story that he dropped off Michelle and Tabitha at Lori's house, went to McDonald's while he waited, and then picked up the girls after they attacked Lori. In his testimony, he reiterated that he had never entered the apartment that morning, and another witness was about to take the stand to corroborate that story. This 98 trial would hear new testimony, one that hadn't been told at the original trial, from someone who finally decided to tell their side of the story, Tabitha Buck. Tabitha had been sentenced to life, and she knew that she had nothing to gain from giving her testimony. But according to Overkill, she wanted to tell Hazel Show what really happened to her daughter and finally close this chapter. In Overkill, she's quoted as saying, "Maybe I'll end up dying in prison, but at least my conscience will be clear." Tabitha took the stand and told the following story. She had hung out with Lawrence and Michelle in the fall of 1991. She and Michelle were not close friends, but she knew that Michelle had an issue with a girl named Lori Show, often referring to her as that bitch. On December 19th, the day before the murder, Tabitha says that Michelle came over to her house crying about Lori and saying that she wanted to get Lori back for dating Lawrence. When Tabitha asked what she was going to do, Michelle responded, "I'll kill her." According to Tabitha, she believed Michelle was all talk. She had never seen Michelle fight, and at the time, Michelle was 7 months pregnant. Tabitha didn't take her seriously. Michelle asked Tabitha to go with her to Lori's the next morning and told Tabitha to wear her hair up, no makeup, and no nail polish. She told Tabitha to also wear sunglasses so that Lori wouldn't recognize her. The next morning, Michelle and Lawrence picked her up from her house, and Lawrence dropped them off by a field near Lori's condominium while he drove off to McDonald's. They weren't sure which apartment was the show's, but they eventually found it. Michelle told Tabitha to knock on the door and ask for Hazel Show. When Tabitha knocked, it was Lori that answered the door. Tabitha asked Lori if her mother was home, but only as a confirmation, because she knew that Michelle had called Hazel the night before and arranged for Hazel to be at a counselor's appointment at school that morning. Once Lori confirmed that Hazel was not in the apartment, Michelle came forward and allegedly pushed her way in. Tabitha says that right away, Michelle and Lori started arguing, pushing each other and wrestling. Lori apparently got away from Michelle at one point and ran towards Tabitha in what Tabitha believes was an attempt to get away. Lori was able to push Tabitha out of the way and knocked her sunglasses off, which is when Tabitha believes she got the scratch on her face. Michelle caught up to Lori and pushed her into the wall as she tried to escape. According to Tabitha, at this point, Michelle had a large kitchen knife. They were fighting for the knife, and at one point, Lori had grabbed the blade, and Michelle pulled it out of her hand. Tabitha said that Lori then struggled away and ran into her bedroom, but Michelle caught up and grabbed her by the hair. Michelle then started cutting chunks of it off with the knife. Tabitha says that at one point, Lori did grab the house phone, but she wasn't sure what happened to it. She saw Michelle smack Lori with the butt of the knife at least twice when she was down. At this point, Michelle then handed Tabitha the knife and tried to get the rope around Lori's neck. According to Tabitha, Michelle kept telling Lori to stop struggling. Lori at one point tried to reach for a pair of scissors that were nearby, but Tabitha said she moved them just out of Lori's reach, while Michelle continued to try and pin her down. After the scissors were moved, Michelle told Tabitha to cut Lori's throat. According to Tabitha, she said no, and then Michelle took the knife back from Tabitha. Michelle made a cut to Lori's leg and told Tabitha to hold Lori's feet down to make her stop kicking. Tabitha sat on Lori's legs and said she looked away until Lori stopped struggling. When she looked back, Lori's throat had been cut, and Michelle was sitting on the floor to her right. Tabitha asked Michelle if Lori was dead, and she responded she didn't know. And then Michelle proceeded to cut Lori's throat several times as though she was, quote, cutting bread. Once she was done, Michelle grabbed the knife by the tip and handed it to Tabitha, who put it in her coat pocket. Michelle told her to put her hood up, and they both walked out of the apartment towards the woods. Lawrence picked them up a little north of the condominium, and they drove back to Lawrence and Michelle's trailer in silence. They took showers, and Tabitha says she left the knife somewhere in the trailer. She changed into an outfit she borrowed from Michelle, and then they drove her to school. This was the first time that the court had heard many of these details, and Tabitha's story strongly matched the information that was gathered from the initial autopsy report. If you remember, Lori had been stabbed twice in the head and was beaten with some sort of blunt object, which was now explained by Tabitha's story to be the butt of the knife. The defensive wounds on her hands matched the story of Lori trying to grab the blade of the knife from Michelle. Tabitha also mentioned that Michelle stabbed Lori in the leg, and the medical examiner had initially said that there was a stab wound to Lori's upper thigh that had penetrated her pelvis. And with this testimony, Tabitha explained why there had been so many slices to Lori's throat. In previous depositions, Tabitha omitted the facts that Michelle put the rope around Lori's throat, that she saw Michelle actually cut Lori's throat, and that Michelle had been the one to call Hazel Show the night before and arrange the counselor meeting. She also omitted how much Michelle talked about her hatred of Lori. When asked why she omitted these details before this, she said that she was always told that the more she said, the more trouble she would get in. And initially, she didn't want Michelle to get a heavier sentence that she was already going to get. Because if you remember from the first trial, the death penalty was initially on the table. But now Tabitha wanted to tell the truth. She told her lawyers that she had purposefully left things out before, specifically how much Michelle talked about Lori. According to Tabitha, Michelle talked about Lori all the time. She constantly talked about how much she wanted to kill Lori, and would think of different ways to do it and ask Tabitha her opinions on them. Tabitha says that she didn't actually think Michelle would do it until she did it. Tabitha wasn't the only person to call Michelle a liar during this trial. In a shocking turn of events, Michelle's parents actually issued a press release on the day of closing arguments that Michelle had lied about a family member sexually assaulting her 10 years earlier. They said it was a total fabrication and left a mark on their family that they couldn't erase. At this point, Michelle had accused 7 different men of sexual assault, and according to her family, at least one of these accusations was false. If you remember from part 2, in addition to Lawrence and the 3 police officers, Michelle accused 2 prison guards of sexual assault as well. While one guard was eventually charged because despite interviews with inmates and staff stating that many believed the relationship was consensual, he was still taking advantage of his position of power, there was no physical evidence to charge any of the others. With this new statement from her parents, Michelle's credibility was once again called into question. Despite being spotted near the scene of the crime, Lawrence Youngkin could not be placed at the apartment the morning of December 20th, 1991. A McDonald's employee who testified that they saw Lawrence that morning corroborated Tabitha's story, and the 2 witnesses from the first trial who said they saw 2 individuals of similar height leave the apartment that morning confirmed that it was Tabitha and Michelle who were there, not the much taller Lawrence, whose height would have stood out to the witnesses. With Lawrence not at the apartment and Tabitha's testimony, it became clear to the court what happened the morning of December 20th, 1991. The trial lasted for weeks, but in August of 1998, Judge Stengel announced his verdict. He stated he would uphold the original guilty verdict against Michelle, and that, quote, even if he believed her story, she would still be guilty of first-degree murder as an accomplice. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania released the following statement. The crime scene photographs, the autopsy photographs, the condition of the condominium, and the condition of the body of Lori Show led this court to one inescapable conclusion. Whoever performed these acts did so with a level of rage completely inconsistent with any accidental killing or death incidental to a prank. We firmly believed in 1992 that Lisa Michelle Lambert drew the knife across the throat of Lori Show, causing her death. She was the only person with the level of emotion, the focus of purpose, and the clear opportunity to have performed that dreadful act. The PCRA court also contends that Lambert was at least guilty of first-degree murder on an accomplice basis. No matter the harsh realities that Lambert may have confronted in her life up to December 20th, 1991, these do not justify her actions in connection with the murder of Lori Show on that day. Lambert is not actually innocent of the murder of Lori Show. Michelle Lambert was once again sentenced to life in prison, where she remains today. She attempted to appeal the 1998 decision in 2003 and to bring the case to the Supreme Court of the United States, but it was rejected. Michelle exhausted all of her appeals in 2005. Lawrence Youngkin had served 12 years and was released on parole on August 24th, 2004. He was 32 at the time of his release. He was originally sentenced to 10 to 20 years for third-degree murder. He was originally up for parole in 2001, but Hazel and John Cho had petitioned his release. One of the conditions of his release in 2004 was that he was to have no contact with the Lambert, Buck, or Cho families. John Cho has stated that he wants no restitution money from Lawrence Youngkin. Shockingly, Tabitha Buck has also been released from prison. Initially, she was sentenced to life when she was 17 years old. But in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled mandatory life sentences for juvenile offenders unconstitutional. Because of this new ruling, on November 22, 2017, Tabitha was resentenced to a term of 28 years to life. Due to her good behavior, demonstrations of remorse, and a positive recommendation from her correctional institution, Tabitha was officially paroled on December 21st, 2019, almost 28 years to the day of Laurie Cho's murder. Hazel Cho is still an advocate for anti-stalking and harassment laws today, and she even helped pass a law in 1993 that provides protective orders and warrantless arrests relative to victims and witnesses of intimidation and abuse. Officer Robin Weaver died earlier this year from cancer. He retired from the force in 2021. Any allegations made by Michelle Lambert were dismissed, and he was cleared of all charges. To this day, Christina Rainville believes that her client Michelle Lambert is still innocent and that the East Lampeter police conducted a cover-up. In 2016, Michelle Lambert co-wrote a book called Love, Murder, and Corruption in Lancaster County. In this book, she still maintains her innocence. Despite the fact that Lisa Michelle Lambert was found guilty in the end, her trial highlighted a potential failure in our justice system. While there were no official charges of misconduct in the end, Lawrence's perjured statement should have never been used to convict Michelle. And even though the East Lampeter police had not dealt with a murder in over a decade, the sloppiness in the investigation, maintenance of reports, and evidence let an alleged murderer walk free for 10 months. Laurie Cho's death helped lead Pennsylvania to enact anti-stalking laws and provide support and protection for those facing harassment. One can only hope that the legacy of her case will be that stalking and harassment will be taken more seriously and stopped early enough so that what happened to Laurie Cho won't happen to anyone else. For more information, training, and how to spread awareness about stalking and harassment, you can visit stalkingawareness.org. And if you or anyone you know is experiencing sexual violence, you can call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673 or visit RAINN, RAINN.org. All our sources will be linked in the show notes, but a special thanks to the book Overkill by Lynn Riddle. This was The Murder of Laurie Cho. This episode was written by Alexa Morrissey, researched by Victoria Cox, and produced by Michael Morrissey, John Scassia, and Heidi Sherriman. Stranger in the House is a Boy Wonder production. You can follow us at strangerinthehouse.com, @_strangerinthehouse on Instagram and TikTok, and @_strangerpod on Twitter. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.